This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as 3 suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest, just delight in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host,
the pride of Pennsylvania,
the man who shoots straight and won't steer you wrong,
Johnny Appleseed himself,
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Mitchell Shirk.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast, the final episode of May. And just another year to prove that hunting seasons during months with hunting seasons go by the fastest. I cannot believe that we're finishing May up. And this has been a very challenging turkey season for me. I've probably hunted more this spring gobbler season than I have for the last couple of turkey seasons. I've been fortunate the previous two seasons that I was able to fill tags pretty quickly. And this year, not the case. I had an opportunity, and I could have. I screwed it up. And, you know, trying to fill that second tag, I ended up hunting quite a bit. Up until Memorial Day here on Monday, and I just have not been able to have much to show for it. I've had some interactions, but it's been challenging, and I got to be real. this end of the season. While I know it can be good, we had a little bit of a switch in weather. It got a little bit cooler, but it's sunny and the pressure's up, and it, you know, kind of excites me in some senses. It also is becoming really, really challenging for me to find the motivation to go. I'm just about ready to throw in the towel on turkeys and switch into something else. You know, I was sitting in the turkey woods and saw a couple deer, and man, I saw one heck of a nice buck when I was turkey hunting out feeding in a soybean field the one morning, and that got my mind thinking to the fall. And it's I think it's probably where the door is beginning to close for turkey season for me. But you know, I'm gonna do my best here. If I can find a window to, maybe even if it's just the final day, to get out and do one more turkey hunt, I'll probably muster up enough energy and enough motivation and try it one more time. But, you know, I had a fun season, learned a lot, and as always, challenging days of turkey hunting are definitely better than a day in the workplace, that's for sure. I'm sure a lot of you can relate to that. This week's episode, I'm going to talk a little bit about some challenging things that we've been facing here in the world of farming and food plotting. And specifically, we're going to talk about being patient and managing your food plots appropriately, especially after a fall of really, really dry weather. And now we're having a fairly wet spring, and depending on what your area specifically seen, it can make some challenges for food plots. And I'm also going to talk about how I'm transitioning a section of unused land that's pretty much, in my mind, fairly useless when it comes to wildlife, and how I'm going to try to transition that into something a little bit more advantageous for wildlife. So we're going to jump right into it. First, we're going to have a quick commercial break from our partners, Radix Hunting. Guys, if you're looking for a blind, a camera, a tree stand, check out Radix Hunting Gear. I can't say enough good things about their blind systems, the Monarch blinds. I was using their pop-up blind for turkey hunting this year. First of all, it's easy to set up, and the silent window features on it. I really like the ability for adjustment height, and it's quick and quiet. Check out Monarch blinds and all that Radix has to offer, especially in the world of cameras. I love those cameras. Huntworth gear. I typically run the Sheldon hoodie and Durham pants during spring turkey season. The level of comfortability and the options that you have with that stuff, I can't rave about enough. You can go on to huntworthgear.com, and you can use their system builder where you can pick the seasons you're hunting under the conditions, and they will narrow down the type of gear that you would want for that season. Very handy. Awesome camo patterns. Check out Huntworth Gear. And lastly, Little Mountain Outfitters. Guys, Little Mountain Outfitters, check it out at littlemountainoutfitters.com. You can see all the gear that they have to offer, from saddle hunting to archery to everything in between. And if you use the code Woodsman10, you can get 10% off on your next purchase. When you're thinking about buying gear for this upcoming fall, and you're shopping around, you don't know what to get, think about supporting the local business. And if you get the opportunity and you're in Richland, Pennsylvania, stop into Little Mountain Outfitters today and have a peek at what they have, and shake your hands with the guys who run that store. Awesome bow technicians who can help you get ready for this fall. Again, that's littlemountainoutfitters.com, and you can use the code Woodsman10 on any purchase you buy off their website. First of all, before you even worry about buying, just check out their website. Awesome site, a lot of stuff to offer for us as hunters. Check it out. Attention archers, would you like to be part of the world's oldest gathering of bow hunters? Then mark your calendars for the annual Pennsylvania Bow Hunters Festival. This annual three-day event is held at the Sullivan County Fairgrounds in Forksville, Pennsylvania, which has been going on since 1957. It's a family-friendly event allowing participants to engage in 10 different archery shooting areas, including 3D, moving small game targets, a timed clay pigeon shoot, a steel boar, and the renowned Forksville running deer target. There's also a ton of food, fellowship, and entertainment to be made. The 2025 festival is scheduled for September 19th to the 21st, with daily hours running 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. This event is organized by a nonprofit committee, and all proceeds support local needs, including youth groups, volunteer fire and ambulance companies, and more. Visit their website at www.pabowhunters.com for more information, and we hope to see you there this year. Okay, let's dive into this week's episode. So, last fall, we had probably one of the most challenging falls for getting food plots and small grains, like farmers would plant wheat, rye, triticale, things like that. Probably one of the most difficult falls that I can remember because the rain just absolutely stopped. I don't remember exactly when it was, but I feel like the month of October into November, I don't think we had a drop of rain for almost 6 weeks, and then when it got to around Thanksgiving, then the rain started coming, but it was too little too late for that establishment. I know plenty of people who had food plots out, myself included, that planted food plots in the fall. I'm talking they were planted in that August-September time frame, and they just really did not take hold very well. There was not a lot of growth there. They just sat there open. When the rains did come, we got a lot of weeds that came through, and now you're dealing with that. And those dry fall food plots that didn't produce much, Mother Nature's void is if there's open space and soil, it's going to put something there. And it might be something that you don't want. It could be annual junk grasses like foxtail, barnyard grass. It could be perennial weeds like plantains, or it could be annual broadleaf weeds. That time of year in the fall, I see a lot of chickweed, henbit, things like that. And, some of that stuff deer will eat, but you're not really getting yourself a lot of value when it comes to tonnage, high quality browse. Not really doing a lot for your soil either, which I'm thinking about food plots from the sense of wildlife and wildlife benefit, but the two go hand in hand when you talk about having something that's doing really something beneficial for cycling nutrients and getting those nutrients into the plant and making it available and healthy to wildlife. Now you fast forward into this spring. We started off this spring in April very, very dry as well, to the point where we had a lot of concerns about spring plantings. We had a lot of concerns about small grain crops like wheat and barley that we're going to combine in farms. We had a lot of concerns that they were going to really, really struggle because we had poor establishment in the fall, and we had not so good growing conditions here this spring. And you can translate that over into the world of food plots. A lot of stuff that just looked very, very poor. Our food plots didn't overwinter very well. They got overtaken with weeds. Then they didn't have a lot of moisture for what was there to take off. And then just like that, the switch flipped. And we get into the month of May, and it started raining. And depending on where you're at in the state of Pennsylvania or across the eastern part of the country here, we had a lot of rain. I mean, I'm thinking from my measurements, in a 10-day span, I had 5 to 6 inches of rain, but the entire month has been raining. Every single week has had a significant amount of rain, between 1 and 3 inches of rain. And that creates a couple other challenges, too. One of the biggest challenges you'll find is, and I've been guilty of this with receiving end, is when it comes to planting food plots in the spring, being impatient. We get a certain amount of time. Like I'm sitting here thinking about my turkey hunting. I want to go turkey hunting, but the only thing I have to show for my successful turkey season is all of the things around my house and in my daily life that I have neglected to take responsibility for and accomplish. And it's kind of the same thing when it comes to food plots. If you want to have a busy life in your normal life system and you've got something like food plots you want to try to squeak in there, you end up finding, okay, well, this is the weekend that I'm going to work at planning my food plots. We're going to go up to, our food plots on Memorial Day weekend, and that's when we're going to plant them, right? And you're going to do all this work in a short amount of time. And what if it's just a little bit too wet? What happens is you end up shooting yourself in the foot more times than not and making the problem a little bit worse. Let's talk about why that might be. Well, first of all, most of us, and I shouldn't say most, a lot of people, you know, I've talked about no-till on this food, on this podcast a lot and had a lot of no-till conversations, but in all reality, a lot of people are using tillage to establish their food plots. And I'll give you an example here where tillage is not necessarily a bad thing given the entire foundation of the fall and spring that I've just laid out. And I'll tell you why it's not a bad idea. One of the food plots that I was helping out on a little bit experienced exactly what we just talked about. It had a failed corn food plot planted into it with a little bit of sorghum and things like that. And so there was a lot of carbon in it that didn't really produce a lot of food. And it got dried out. And then through that got planted a fall blend that had some cereal grains and a couple other things. And that established, you know, kind of so-so. And there's some rye and some you know, different fall blends in there. But then there's a lot of chickweed. There's a lot of junk grasses that just don't have a lot of benefit for wildlife. And that food plot, when you looked at it here, the end of May, it's this giant, thick mat of carbon. And you know, for those of you who have done the whole layering of a cereal grain, you know, layering a cereal grain for a food plot isn't necessarily a bad thing from the food plot standpoint. It can just get really, really challenging to manage a lot of carbon, a lot of straw that might come from wheat, rye, or sorghum, or stuff like that. You get that much on there, and you want to no-till your food plots, that gets challenging. So then you get into tilling, and that's where we're circling back here. Tilling is not necessarily a bad sense of what we've seen in this situation. A lot of material on top. You got a really, really hard soil surface to even run a no-till drill through. Like, it's really hard to have a successful stand of running a drill through and cutting a slice in the soil with all that carbon on top. And you're better off in some senses tilling. So I'm going to make the case that a good use of tillage is to mix up the carbon, advance microbial activity, break some of that stuff down, and then, you know, get a good seed bed to get a food plot started. So there's a good case where tilling is good, or is a useful tool, I'll say. I won't necessarily say it's good, but it's a useful tool. But one time that it's really bad is when we're using tillage to dry out the soil. It's just borderline, it's not quite dry enough to plant, but if I till it, I'll mix it up and it'll oxidize the soil, it'll dry it out a little bit, and then it'll get fit to plant. That's probably one of the worst things you can do. And the reason for that is it's just like making a cake batter. What happens when you lose the moisture out of it? It dries out and it gets really hard and clumpy. And usually what happens is whatever level that your tillage is set, let's just say you've got your tiller set for 4 inches deep and it's tilling to 4 inches deep. Wherever those tines stop with the soil, if there's moisture in the ground, believe it or not, even those little narrow blades, those tines, they are making a compaction layer. And they are pushing the ground down. Now, it's lifting up that first 4 inches of soil and making it nice and fluffy, but it's pushing down at that 4-inch layer. And that's where you see droughts really take hold of your food plots. You'll start your food plot, it'll get started real well, but then you get to this compacted layer wherever your tillage stops and your roots can't break through it. And then the rains stop, and your roots aren't going deeper to chase moisture, and that's where you have failed food plots. So that's one time it's bad, and you'll find that when you're trying to squeak food plots in during little narrow windows, and it's just borderline, that's where you'll have a lot of problems. So first of all, what I'm going to say right now, if you are still trying to plant spring food plots. All right, everyone, it's that time of year where things are greening up and I'm starting to think about food plots. And if you're doing the same thing, look no farther than Vitalize Seed, specifically Nitro Boost spring and summer planting. It's the food plot that has the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen and add diversity to your food plot mix. It's highly browse tolerant and adds a ton of benefit, not just to the wildlife, but for your soil. 30% more diversity than any other food plot you're going to find, and it's It's engineered for the proper carbon to nitrogen ratio to naturally feed your soil biology and set you up for a fall food plot like no other. Diversity is king for your wildlife and for your soil. Look no farther and check out Vitalize Seed.
Dreaming of owning a hunting property, small farm, or remote homestead? Or maybe it's time to sell and move on to your next adventure. Whatever your dream is, Steve Choco and Base Camp Country Real Estate can make it happen. Base Camp Country Real Estate land professional Steve Choco is dedicated to providing unparalleled service in the land real estate market. With national advertising power that turns for sale into sold fast, visit us online at chocoforester.com or call Steve today at 814-360-4510. Again, 814-360-4510.
Forget about the calendar. Ignore the calendar. In some cases in the world of agriculture, I can't say that necessarily. We've got some deadlines and things we have to think about before we make adjustments. But for your food plot, if you're talking about planting an annual screening, a summer food plot like Nitro Boost or something along those lines, forget about the calendar for now and wait until you've got optimum planting conditions and get it started right. Even if you don't get as much biomass, you're going to be leaps and bounds farther ahead if you get a nice established food plot that you can start to manage the weeds a whole lot easier and manage your seed beds and things like that. Another thing that I want to talk about when it comes to tilling and the kind of the scenario that I laid out here. So we had some failed food plots from the sense of fall was rough, even some spring food plots. You know, this food plot that I just kind of described to you had a failed corn food plot in 2024, had kind of a semi-failed fall food plot just because of the timing and the dry weather, and you had all this junk material on top. Now we're going to go in there and we're going to till all of that organic material under, make the seed bed fit to plant Nitro Boost into, and then we're going to hopefully plant carbon load into it in the fall. And with all the weeds and all the junk that has come there, one of the biggest fails that I have seen, and I have a lot to back with this when it comes to the farming world, but it's when you till and you, again, speed up microbial processes, it heats the soil up, and you expose the soil to the sunlight, the first thing that happens is a flush of weeds come. And all too often, especially in the springtime, this is where I have the biggest fails with food plots, especially multi-species food plots that you don't have the ability to use a herbicide on. That is where I will see a tillage pass happen, a planting the same day, whether it's a drill going across the field, or maybe you're broadcasting the seed and then cultipacking, or running a disc or a harrow or some kind of chain drag or something along the lines to cover those seeds, and you plant that food plot. What happens is the food plot itself, the weeds are going to germinate at the exact same time as your new food plot seeds are coming, because you've prepared the seed bed for all the weed seeds that were in there. You just made it a perfect scenario of turning that over, exposing it to heat, exposing it to sun, and they're going to germinate at the same time. What you find is when they germinate the same time, the weeds almost always win, because usually their populations of seed are way, way higher in those in those situations in which you planted it, and they just have a natural way of choking it out and making your desired food plot thinner. So how do you combat that? My suggestion in this situation is till it and let it sit about 10 to 14 days. And by doing that, there's a couple risks, but there's a couple benefits. The risks, if you till and let it sit, and we get a really, really heavy rainstorm, I'm talking a gully washer, you know, 50-year type storm, we're going to lose some topsoil. We're going to make a mess of that field, and it's going to create some issues. However, if it's a risk that we think we're willing to take, given the slope and the soil and everything else, if you till it and let it sit, what's going to happen is in that first 10 to 14 days, you're going to get a high peak of weeds that will flush out of that field. And once you get that weed flush, then you terminate them. And you can terminate them one of two ways. My preferred way to terminate them is use a standard application of Roundup, glyphosate, spray those weeds dead. That way, I don't need to do any more tillage work. I don't need to do any more soil disturbance. I can go right in there and broadcast seed on top of that freshly tilled earth, or I can go in with a drill and plant right into that, but kill that first flush. That is going to buy a whole lot of time for the seeds that you plant immediately after you spray to get a head start of a second batch of weeds that might germinate. You're going to continue to get weeds that'll germinate throughout that time, but it's going to be significantly reduced after that first big flush. So again, let it sit 10 to 14 days. You're going to start to see them weeds coming up. I don't care if you plant first. I don't care if you spray first. Do it the same day. Spray with glyphosate, plant the food plot, walk away, time it with rain, and make sure you're doing it when the ground's fit. You shouldn't be making mud balls in that dirt when you grab it. You should be able to grab the soil, and you should kind of see it crumble in your hands a little bit. You know, I always talk, the number that comes to my mind is 30% moisture. That doesn't mean a lot to you guys, but at 30% moisture, that you're not going to make a mud ball with that. You're going to probably crumble the ground up a little bit, and it's going to be real nice. So that's kind of some of the challenges we faced. Forget about the calendar. Let's just be patient and get it started right this year. If any of your food plots kind of resemble that situation, hopefully that's something that's helpful for you. Now I want to talk about something that I'm doing this year with a piece of land that I feel is fairly unutilized. It's pretty much a wasteland in my mind. What it is right now, it's just grown fallow. There's a ton of perennial grasses. You know, I'm not sure what all these species of grasses are. I tell you what, that's one thing I'm fairly weak at is my grass identification. In the world of farming, I really don't enjoy looking at hay and grass hay and managing grass hay. It's a pain in my opinion. But we manage hay fields in farming, such as orchard grass and timothies and fescues and stuff, and we'll make hay forages out of that. And sometimes different grasses like that will find their way into old field settings, and they just kind of get established, and those perennial grasses are there. Well, perennial grasses, most grasses, in my opinion, when it comes to thinking about deer and turkey and stuff like that, like, there's some benefit from the cover aspect, but they depend on the species, and they can get really, really thick to the point where they actually don't get utilized. And they'll also get so thick that you don't have a lot of browse and quality food components to those those areas. So what I'm going to do is take this old area that's about 1 to 2 acres, and I am going to convert it to better used wildlife habitat or better used hunting strategy. The setting, it has road exposure, so I don't really like the idea of turning it into this big green lush clover food plot or a nitro boost carbon load food plot. I don't really want to attract the deer that they can be seen from the road and that the entire neighborhood can see them, and the chances of them coming out in daylight maybe will get reduced over time. But I would like this to be something that the deer feel comfortable using during daylight. And I think in order to do that, I got to get something that has a little bit taller cover. I want taller cover so that way, hopefully the deer feel a little bit more secure bedding in it, utilizing it, walking through it during daylight hours. But it's also going to block things from the road. And it's an area where I think once it's established, people are going to probably not even really pay attention to it. But how am I doing that? Well, I'm doing it with minimal equipment. I don't have a lot of equipment at my disposal right at this location. And the main piece of equipment I'm using is a backpack sprayer and a broadcast spinner seeder. So what I'm doing, in order to get rid of these well-established, deep-rooted perennial grasses, I'm going out now. I'm going out in stages this spring, basically around when I have time and when I can do it. But I'm going out when these plants are young, they're small and actively growing, and I'm hitting them with Roundup, glyphosate. And I'm terminating as much of the grass as possible. In fact, I'm terminating everything. There's a heavy layer of grass thatch from all the years that are there. Then it grows up through that and, you know, starts all over again. And if we try to mow that or spray it later and plant it, you're just going to find that that thatch that's there from all that time is going to really, really inhibit anything you want to plant in the future. And the other thing is, if you spray perennial deep-rooted grasses one time, let's just say you have something like this similar and you want to plant food plots this year. Let's say you want to transition it into a food plot this fall. If you spray it one time with Roundup, I guarantee you that there's a percentage of those grasses that are going to come back. What happens is you kill a percentage of the rootstock, but there's so much energy in the roots of some perennial grasses that just come right back, and you end up having to hit them multiple times. So what am I doing? I'm going out and I'm terminating everything on the surface with an application of Roundup. It's going to give me, I'm hoping, a 75% kill. But what's going to happen as we go throughout the summer, two things are going to happen. There's going to be a benefit and there's going to be a follow-up. The benefit is, with nothing actively growing and the sun beating down on these grasses, the sun is actually going to break down some of that grass a little bit better and get it that it'll slowly start to expose the soil that I can do something with it from the planting sense. Because remember, I'm not planting this with a drill. I'm not bringing a tractor in here and tilling it. And that's another thing I want to touch on. So, you know, a lot of people talk about, I don't like using herbicides. Guess what? I don't like using herbicides either. They kind of gross me out a little bit. You know, I have to wear personal protective equipment, rubber gloves, you know, body covers and stuff like this. You know, I use the chemical, mix it up, sprayed it. Cleaning a sprayer out is a pain. Depending on the chemicals you use, there's sticky films that just kind of stick to everything, and you end up using, you know, cleaners like acetone or ammonia is usually the one, not acetone, ammonia, or, you know, maybe you buy a sprayer cleaner. I don't like spraying either, but you know what? Spraying is definitely a simple tool. And that's what it's used for, a tool. My goal is to use this a couple times to get this established, and then hopefully I don't really have to use herbicide after that. Your other option in trying to terminate something like this is heavy, heavy tillage. If you go out into something like this that is just this sod layer with all these roots and stuff, you're not going to be able to break that up with a chisel. You're going to make a mess with a chisel. The only way that I have found in order to terminate something like that is a moldboard plow. And I'm talking about digging down quite a ways, turning that soil over. Then you have to go back and disc it multiple times to break up those clods. They have to dry out, let that sod kind of break down a little bit. Then you disc it. And to me, that's a mess. It's more expensive. And I really don't like tillage. When you think about using glyphosate as a killer to kill something, you know, typically I make a recommendation in the farming world for glyphosate to be used at 1 quart per acre, and 1 quart, that's 32 ounces on 1 acre. And then what you're doing is we're usually spraying it in a volume of 15 gallons of water per acre. So you do the math. You're taking 15 gallons of water and you're spraying a mist over top of 1 acre, 43,560 square feet. And across that, that volume you're talking about is going across 1 acre. And here's another thing, too. Most people, and I'm guilty of it, too, when you talk about a backpack sprayer, you end up putting way more herbicide in that backpack sprayer, that 4-gallon backpack sprayer, than you need when you compare it to standard agricultural practices. Think about that. 32 ounces in 15 gallons of water. When you take that ratio and you break it down into 4 gallons, you're talking like a quarter to a half an ounce of Roundup in the entire, per gallon of water, I should say. Like a quarter to a half an ounce, I believe it is. Do the math. You could call BS on me with the numbers I'm telling, but I think off the top of my head, that's what it is. So it's a very, very light rate, and a lot of people are putting 1 to 2 ounces in a gallon of water of Roundup, and that's just extremely high. So if you're using appropriate rates, you make the decision if it's really worth it or not. All right, I'm off on my tangent. I'm going to go back into the establishment here. So I was talking a little bit about getting them terminated. So I'm spraying it once this spring. And then what I'm going to do is I'm just going to keep following up and looking at this field. And as it goes through the summer, it's going to break down the thatches. You're going to see, we're going to get rains to come. And some of that stuff is going to bounce back. It's going to re-germinate. So what I'm going to do is go out and spot spray. There's going to be big clumps of different grasses and stuff that'll revive. And I'm going to hit it a second time, just to make sure I get as much of that grass gone. Because if I don't, it will creep back in, and those perennials are always going to overtake whatever you start. Even if you're starting another perennial or you're planting an annual food plot, they are going to overtake that because they've got so much root mass and below ground energy. They're just always going to outcompete for nutrients and moisture. Once I get this area that it's pretty well clear of the grass this year, I want to, my end goal, I want to put this into a stand of mixed switchgrass. I would like to use a tall variety of switchgrass that's going to get maybe 5-6 feet tall, that it has a cover component. Now, I don't want the field to be completely switchgrass, just a solid, row crop like field of switchgrass. I want it to be established, but patches. And then the places where it doesn't grow, if I'm hoping to get maybe 40-50% establishment, and then the rest of the plot, I'd like broadleaf forbs and weeds and stuff like that to come up as a browse factor. I don't want other grasses coming up. I would love broadleaf stuff like goldenrod and who knows, greenbrier, and there's all kinds of forbs that can come up that are going to have a benefit for browsing. So you'll have the cover aspect, the bedding aspect, and then you'll have something where they'll browse and hopefully just spend a little bit more time, and it just so happens to be adjacent from a place that I'm able to sit with a bow. But in order to establish that switchgrass, switchgrass I like to establish in, you can plant that in late fall and winter as a frost seed. Typically you're seeing that get planted in the early spring. And one of the things that I'm going to be challenged with is I'm still going to have a lot of grass thatch on top, and I'd like to see some of that break down a little bit more. So the way I'm going to do that is for the first year, in order to get this field, basically get the seed bed managed and get the soil surface and the carbon managed, I'm going to plant it in a food plot this year. It's going to be one year where it's going to be going against the goals I set up front, where it's going to be exposed to people and there's going to have, deer might use it at night and blah, 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 blah. But if I can plant it in a food plot, I'm going to talk to Al a little bit and see what he thinks we should do. I could plant carbon load, but I'm really thinking that I want to plant something that's a little bit lower in carbon to nitrogen ratio. I'm thinking about doing something that's got more clovers, more brassicas, maybe a little bit less on the cereal grains, and using small seeded things like those, not necessarily like peas and beans and stuff like that. I want to have small seeded plants that are low in carbon to nitrogen ratio, because my hope is that it's going to break down and advance some of that cycling of that carbon, and it's going to make an even nicer seed bed for me to establish my switchgrass in. So let's just say I've got a mix of clovers, maybe brassica, something like that. I know for this region what's going to happen is I'm going to get that established, assuming that we've got good rain. The deer are going to come throughout the fall, the winter, and the early spring, and they are going to eat that down to the dirt. I guarantee it. With the deer that are here and what I've experienced in these food plots, they are going to keep that lip high, and there's going to be dirt exposed. And that is going to make a perfect, perfect scenario that I don't have to do anything other than broadcast switchgrass seed into that in February, March timeframe next year in 2026, when we've got a freeze-thaw condition and frost seed. The deer are going to do all the work for me. The plants are going to do all the work for me. All I did was terminate those grasses. The deer are going to eat down, expose the soil, because their hooves are going to probably get, and when it gets muddy and stuff like that, and they're going to till the ground up in a sense just a little bit, and I'm going to have just enough soil exposure to put switchgrass seed in there, frost seed it, and let that freeze and thaw work through. And then I'm going to let it sit, and I'm going to let it do its magic. And then how it comes up is how it comes up. I don't really care if we get some weeds early on in the establishment. As long as the switchgrass gets established, I don't really care how it looks. As long as I've got a general makeup of how I described earlier, it's going to take a full year for that to get established, and that's going to begin the process. But by doing that, I've removed the plants I don't want. I allowed minimum tools. The only thing that I have into this is a backpack sprayer and sweat equity and a broadcast spinner. It's going to take me some time. There's definitely a timeline in establishing. A lot of people, especially when it comes to switchgrass, we have this mindset of instant gratification when it comes to planting food plots. Anytime you plant an annual food plot like Nitro Boost or Carbon Load, you plant those in the right conditions. 3 days later, you're going to start to see stuff germinating. Not the case for switchgrass, not the case for clover, not the case for alfalfa, any perennials. They take a long time. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, have you ever tried to reseed grass in your yard, reseed a perennial grass? It takes forever. It is not a quick process. But if you, like I said, take the time. Like I could do this quicker if I used heavier equipment, but then I'm renting and more time and this and that. I'm okay with the timeline, and I think that's what I'm getting at with this whole thing, is be patient and allow time to take its course with the tools you have, and you can get a good food plot or switchgrass field established. You just got to make sure you're doing your best job to replace the plants that you don't want, get rid of them to establish the plants that you do need. This concept sounds simple, but when you're talking about perennial establishment, I think it's a little bit more difficult. That's what I got you for you this week. We talked about the food plot challenges that we're facing this year and things to think about as you're going into this fall. Guys, if you're not, if you haven't planted food plots or you're trying to figure out what to do, again, Vitalize Seed is a sponsor of this show, and I have to give you the commercial sense, but in all truthfulness, they wouldn't have to be a partner for this show for me to use it, because what they're doing in taking species and blending them together at the optimum ratios and then allowing them to be great food for wildlife, but also cycle nutrients, cycle material, organic material, and let it become a plant available nutrient and organic matter in the soil. There's a ton of benefit to this system, and I have tried so many times to make my own seed blends, and sometimes I have been successful, sometimes I have failed in getting my ratios wrong, and it really gets to a point where it's such a pain in the neck and it's so time consuming, I just don't want to bother, because I don't have that background of R&D, research and development, into those seed blends. I know what I want, but they know what I want as far as food availability and nitrogen and plant cycling. So I just let the professionals handle it. The guys that have done that hard work and know what needs to be in that blend, I let them handle it. And that's why I get stuff from guys like Al. And I'm proud to work with them, and I can't wait to use more of their food plots this year. So I encourage you to check check their food plots out if you haven't already done so. And that's what we got for you this week. I appreciate you joining us. We'll catch you right back here next week for our first episode in June as we get into a transition period of talking from turkeys and summer management to fall prep. And I can't wait to do it. I'm looking forward to deer season. I'm looking forward to fun things in the fall, maybe doing some fishing with my kids, things like that, going to the cabin, enjoying creation. That's what it's all about. All right, guys, have a great week. And we'll catch you on the next one.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel, because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Well, the holidays have come and gone once again, but if you've forgotten to get that special someone in your life a gift, well, Mint Mobile is extending their holiday offer of half off unlimited wireless. So here's the idea. You get it now. You call it an early present for next year. What do you have to lose?
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Limited time 50% off regular price for new customers. Upfront payment required. $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds may slow after 50 gigabytes per month when network is busy. See terms.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.